Hey, this is John Lee Dumas of the award-winning podcast, Entrepreneurs on Fire, and you're listening to the Excelsior Journeys with George Soroy. Prepare to ignite.
So would you say that that's kind of like the lightning bolt moment for
you? And that's
why
I taught myself how to draw, was actually the Little Mermaid, drawing stills of Ariel.
I've got better things to do tonight than die.
Sylvester jumped out of his chair and said, who the F is this?
I remember walking out of the theater with him saying, I'm going to write Halloween.
I'm rather impressed with your research. Rarely do people ask me about Children in the Corn.
It doesn't have to be perfect. Just do it. You know, throw some spaghetti against a wall. See if it sticks.
This is George Soroy saying to all of you, ever upward.
Welcome back to Excelsior Journeys, the road to creativity, part of the Podmatch podcast network. This is George Soroy, and thank you so much for being here. And there's a wonderful moment right at the very beginning of a retrospective documentary that's on the discs for the Superman series. And this was back in 2006 when this came out, when screenwriter Sam Hamm, who was one of the critical forces of the Tim Burton Batman films, where he basically said that when it came to a film, it was kind of limiting because when you can basically draw and write whatever you can think of, but you can't film whatever you can think of. And as time has gone on, we have really gotten, we've seen the evolution of that wonderful, crucial element of all the films, which is visual effects. And we have seen that just evolve more and more since the time that the film began. And we are seeing some very exciting times right now where not only are you able to film and create more of what you can think of, but you're also able to see visual effects transcend into all genres of film. And so it's not just sci-fi and horror and fantasy and children's films or whatever. It's evolving and transcending way beyond that. And so it's really exciting when I hear from a visual effects artist who is ready to tell their story about how they got into this wonderful field. And that's why I'm so happy to introduce my guest this week, Taylor Rockwell. She started out in stage management and directing, and she has gotten into visual effects and really created a true love for it, and has lent her expertise to films such as Evan Almighty, Journey to the Center of the Earth, the Red Dawn remake, The Amazing Spider-Man 2, Fury, and the wonderful 1-2 punch that is The Cabin in the Woods and The Avengers. And as soon as I saw the list of different films that she was involved in, I just knew she has to be on the show. And she's got to tell her story on this. I am so excited to hear her journey that led her from the stage to the big screen. And so it is my thrill to introduce my guest this week, Taylor Rockwell. Taylor, how are you?
Thank you so much for having me. I'm fantastic. Very excited about this.
Yes, me too. Me too. I've been just a lover of film almost since the day I was born. And it's always been something that I've wanted to be a part of. And when I couldn't actually get my stuff out there on the big screen, then I decided to shift over to books, the audio drama that I have. And then also the audiobook narrating and telling the story that way. And then finally the podcasting, where I get to meet with different people that I otherwise would not have been able to, and to hear their stories and to see, basically just get the full rundown of how someone got to where they are in the field that they've chosen. And so just having you on here, I think that's wonderful. So thank you again for being on here.
You're so welcome. I was really surprised that you started with a Superman anecdote because and mentioning that I came from theater, because my background, my family is in theater and was part of the transition from radio and theater to television, and actually have right here happened to. My grandfather was Jor-El on the original Superman TV show.
No way.
Yes. Yeah, so
no way.
And he was like a dad to me, and I lived with him my whole life growing up. So Robert Rockwell, the original Jor-El from the black and white TV show. And so that's where it all started.
That is awesome. And that is so wonderfully unexpected, because I did not tell you I was going to dive into that.
So no, that is... no, not at all. No, I don't know anything that's coming, which is exciting. But yeah, so I got my love from theater from my family, and I decided that behind the scenes was my jam. I was not a performer. And so I got into stage managing and directing, and I just loved it. And I love the live aspect of it. And you have to figure it out in the moment. There is absolutely no saving you. And I think my family really thrives on that chaos. But I plan to do stage management, and then I did it in college briefly, and briefly professionally in air quotes, and worked really hard for several months and got a check for $100. And I was like, okay, it's been great, theater. Thanks so much. But I've got to be able to support myself. So I ended up having a lot of internships in film in areas that I hated. And this is my advice to people wondering where they belong in film. And it's just to try it out and find out what you hate, because what you don't like will lead you to what you do like. And so even though I was not happy during those internships, and it was in, you know, areas where I have great friends and they love it, like development and, you know, research and editorial, and I just wasn't really jiving with it. I ran into a visual effects executive that was like a family friend, and she said, what do you like about your internships and what don't you like? And I said, I love keeping track of things. I love being organized, but I also love chaos. I love the live in the moment pressure. And she said, I think visual effects would be great for you. And I had no idea that all this time I was a visual effects fan until I really got into visual effects.
Nice.
And I was like, wait a minute, I've always loved this, because Jurassic Park is like my Star Wars. Like, I love Jurassic Park more than anything. That movie only has 45 visual effects shots in it.
Really?
Which is incredible. And yeah, there's so much practical in that movie, which is fantastic. And
yeah, so much in-camera moments. Yeah.
Yeah. The handoff is what I love most about visual effects, is working with the other departments, which I'll definitely get into. But I was interested in visual effects. I had no idea what it was. And I ended up getting a PA job on Evan Almighty and was supposed to be there for 6 weeks. And I ended up being there for 9 months of production and post. And that was 20
Nine
years
months.
Ago.
Wow.
Yeah. So,
most of that was like post-production, right? Like that, because
I was on the last 9 months of the movie, and they had shot principal production in Virginia, which I was not around for. But then they came back to Universal on the lot and had an animal unit for all of the blue screen elements of animals all throughout the movie, which was a dream, because it was MOS, no sound recording. And so you didn't have to worry about being loud on set, although with the animals you did. So my very first film experience was being on a Universal Studios stage, all coved out in blue screen all around, and, you know, with a hyena just doing his thing. And we had a saying on that movie called "In the Cage or Off the Stage," because the camera and Video Village and all of the crew was in a cage on the stage. And then the animals we were shooting were allowed to roam free. So we had to be either in the cage or off the stage. And so it was a dream. I was, for all the animals that we had to recreate in CG, I was in charge of getting the vendor photographers, like from Rhythm and Hues, which is a great visual effects company that's no longer really around, but not in the same way they used to be. And so I just got to hang out with animals and shoot blue screen like a zoo every day. It was kind of insane how wonderful it was. And so I was immediately hooked. I was like, this is work. You're paying me to do this. And that was 20 years ago. And I've just worked my way from, I started as a production assistant, and I worked my way up to coordinator. And then there's a few other kind of more specific titles in between that studios want to see on your resume, like a production manager or like some kind of department head that isn't producer, before they want to promote you to producers. I did all those. And then the last several years I've been visual effects producing, which has been great. But the visual effects department is interesting. Just for people that aren't familiar, to be super obvious, visual effects is everything that is put in the movie after it's shot. And in order to do that, we have to be on the movie from prep to post. And so people don't realize that as a visual effects department head, I'm on the movie the longest, except for the director. And so I get, you know, an early script, tell them how much I think the visual effects is going to cost. And then every iteration of the script from that, I just keep doing that. And then as we shoot, I make sure we're shooting it in the way that we have agreed to do the shot at the end of the day, so that we're staying in our budget. I'm in charge of the budget and the logistics for the department, which I really love. And then there's a co-department head, the visual effects supervisor, that is the technical and creative. And so usually that person has come from a photography or visual effects artist background. And usually there is not one department head. There are a few people that do it that can produce and supervise visual effects, but that those things, the technical creative and the logistics and budgeting don't always exist in the same brain. And frankly, it's terrifying if you can do all that, because you're just using too much of your brain. But so I really love the collaboration of having a co-department head and leading the team together. And we, you know, we know each other's jobs to a certain extent so that we can, you know, work together and speak on behalf of each other and things like that. There's a nice mix in visual effects of just kind of paying attention and predicting the future. We're planning for plans A, B, and C, and then knowing that plan D is probably what's going to happen. And just being ready for that, even during shooting and every step of the way, it's high pressure because there's a lot of money. We're a huge line item in a movie budget, so there's a lot of scrutiny.
Now, having worked on Evan Almighty and really kind of feeling that sort of getting bitten by that bug, you can say, and just really loving what you were doing, how long did it take before the next one came around? And when you did, were you able to just like really kind of plow forward on that?
That's such a good question. I was off for a little bit. The weird thing with visual effects freelance is, it's not consistent. It's job to job, movie to movie. And so you really have to get your name out there and make sure people know that you're around and what you can do. And I got a great opportunity where the coordinator that I was working under on Evan Almighty ended up going on to take over for some crew on another movie that was leaving. And she took me with her. And so we both were able to go to Journey to the Center of the Earth over at Walden. That was another movie where I was picking up other people's, you know, work a year into it. They were well into post when I joined, but that movie was fascinating because they shot it in 3D and we did the visual effects in 3D, and it just made everything a lot harder than it needed to be, but it was exciting and cool. And I got there and thought I knew how to do the job, and boy, was I mistaken. I did know how to do the job, but I knew how to do the job on Evan Almighty. I didn't know how to do the job on Journey to the Center of the Earth. And so the first 2 or 3 weeks was really, really hard of that second job. And that was really learning that each movie is kind of like a temporary entity, in that it only has to operate for a year and a half. And it doesn't have to operate perfectly, but it just has to move forward. There's no rule book with visual effects. There's no standards and practices. And so being comfortable enough to like trust my instincts and just go with it and not get hung up on, oh, I don't know this, I don't know that, was a hard lesson to learn. But it also, you know, taught me that there's a learning curve for every single movie, and every single movie has such different dynamics, you know, from the top down. And so it just kind of is another way to stay on my toes and just be ready for anything. 'Cause we all have the same goal at the end of the day, which is the great part.
Yeah. Yeah. Everyone wants the movie to look the very best it can. Because that's a testament to everyone who works on it. So, and those credit lists, you know, like they can be pretty vast. And
for sure.
So And so when you're doing that, when you're trying to basically just try to get your name out there, I remember there was talk on the development of Star Trek V, how they kind of realized like how much of a limited amount they had for their budget. And ILM was not available at the time. They were getting ready to get this movie out in 1989, and ILM was doing everything at that point. Yep. What do you have to do in order to kind of like get yourself out there in terms of like, because I'm sure that the space is getting a little bit more crowded, right?
If we talk about today, it's a very different, it's completely different. The whole entire industry has changed. You can't compare it, because back when I started visual effects, I was like, oh, I'll work forever. There will never not be a need for visual effects. And the way that it's developed is, how should I put this? Frankly, right now, they're just not making as many movies, and there aren't as many opportunities to go around, and visual effects houses are providing their own crew, and studios see that as a really attractive option, even though the people at the visual effects house don't know the job of the production side visual effects producer. So just because it's the same title, it's a very different job. And so for the last 10 years, that's really been something that I've had to contend with, is, you know, options that studios go with that are more affordable and less a lot of TV shows that started up would take the visual effects team from a movie and put them on a TV show. This happened at Marvel, and they'd never done visual effects in production before, and so they didn't know what they were doing, and that's just not fair to anybody involved, frankly. You know, it all comes down to studios trying to save money, but I'm always happy when a movie has a line item for a full visual effects team on it, which is rare, unfortunately, now, and shouldn't only be the tentpole movies. You shouldn't have to have 2,000 visual effects shots in order to have a proper visual effects department, because the way that we support the director and editorial and all the other departments is not something that the vendors have experience in doing. And I, as a producer, I've been on movies where we've had 14 visual effects companies working for us. And so we've got to oversee all of that. So even on the smallest shows, we'll have 3, 5, 7 vendors, just bending, depending on the state of things in the industry. Yeah.
Do you basically just like put it out there, just saying like, hey, my team can keep your budgets low?
Yeah, I mean, it's so much experience. It's knowing that you're going to have overages, and it's managing everyone's expectations of what they're going to be. So like during shooting, I'll report overages that will turn into some kind of other overage down the line. Like, and so it's about staying ahead of the game and trying to predict what people will want. And that really just comes with time and experience. Another thing I'm dealing with now is people that used to be coordinators that are moving up, that are doing my same job at half my rate. And so they don't quite have the experience either. It's just been, it's been hard losing jobs to people that used to be on my team underneath me, and seeing them sometimes get in over their head and wishing that that didn't happen. I'll just keep coming back to this. I just wish there was as many movies being made now as there were 10 years ago, because I really thought, oh, I'll work forever. And to your point earlier, there is no movie that does not have visual effects, no matter what. Yep. Even if it's modern day today, it's just making something cleaned up and how the filmmakers want it. You'd be surprised at how many, you know, can you just green up this tree? Can you clean up this roadway mess? And it really helps focus the storytelling on what the director wants you to see in each shot. Basically, anything is possible with visual effects, which is a blessing and a curse, because, you know, it's possible, but it needs time and money in order to look good. So,
and since you said anything is possible, there's always that trial and error period. Have you experienced that, where you've had to basically just kind of, I think it was George Lucas who said, like, we had to build, or one of the guys on the original ILM team, like, they had to build the factory before they made the first can of beans. So have you experienced something like that, where you had to kind of, like, you were kind of the next step in this type of visual effects trend?
I'm proud to say that I headed up the building of the original Hulk in the first Avengers movie. And so that movie was a huge risk and a huge swing. And
that was their culmination of all of phase one at the time. And if that didn't work, which, and granted, it's one of those things where just like, how could it have not worked? But anything is
possible. Well, there's plenty of superhero movies that are not working anymore these days.
Yeah. Sadly, yes.
No, we got really lucky, and we had ILM heading that up with the great Jeff White. So yeah, I was production side, like the lead coordinator, and we were shooting and prepping in New Mexico, which I loved, actually. But we incorporated every single kind of photography and scanning in order to build the Hulk and all the CG characters in the Avengers. And that involved millions of dollars of equipment and people, you know, being transported to New Mexico, set up, built a whole like circuit of photography rooms and scanning rooms and reference rooms and things like that. And so there was like a week I was in charge of getting every single actor in every single look that we would need to recreate as CG through this pipeline. I've spent a lot of time in a room with Mark Ruffalo where he's barely clothed, God bless him. I've seen a lot of him. I have a joke that I say, you know, there's this guy at work that won't stop taking his clothes off around me, Mark Ruffalo. But the most wonderful, sweetest person. And I was so glad to get to do this journey with him. And it started in prep in Los Angeles where we took our actors to something called the Light Stage, which is a bubble of a few hundred cameras and lighting. Mm-hmm. And so it recreates any possible lighting that we may have to match in visual effects. And it has a few hundred cameras that all go off at one time. So it'll shine a certain lighting in a certain direction and all the cameras will pop off and you'll have a perfect reference of that actor's face in that particular lighting, and that we can use as reference once we get down the road in post-production. It's still being used, but it's a very cool photography style light stage, and it feels very high-tech. And so now we build kind of miniature light stages and like arrays of cameras in order to capture lighting reference and reference of just what the actors look like with different mouth shapes and saying different words and different poses. So we did the light stage. And then during the week in Albuquerque, we had a scanning truck and a few photography rooms and then a video that recorded people saying some of their lines that we may have to have their digital doubles say just for the reference and things like that. Some of my best memories are Return of the Golf Cart. I love golf carts. The Mark Ruffalo driving me around the studio in Albuquerque in just his bathrobe, and he was driving the golf cart that I brought.
He was driving
him.
You?
He was driving me. You know, Robert Downey Jr. did not want to get scanned, and it's like, dude, this is your whole movie. Like, do you want the stunt double to look like you or not? Mm-hmm. And so we had to recruit our director and producers to bring him, to convince him to come get scanned and photographed, and he did it, and we got what we needed. But sometimes it takes a village.
Well, I can now that actually kind of plays in well with what they're recently saying on the news about how he's been just kind of warning Disney not to use AI of his likeness without his permission.
Yeah.
So that's very, very, that's, hey, he was thinking ahead.
It was 2011 and Scarlett Johansson said, what's going to happen with these scans? And I was like, girl, you have every right to know that. And they are kept under lock and key and several authentication pages away from anyone that could get it. But yes, Disney does have all that material buried deep.
Yeah. And, you know, they're keeping the actual actors involved with everything.
That is
a great thing. And with everything that you've been working on, especially like, you know, with something as effects heavy and as epic really as that first Avengers movie, because like, I mean, there are shots in there that were just like I remember just like sitting in the theater on opening weekend watching it and just getting that wonderful chill up your spine to saying like, oh my God, this is actually happening. And you know, everyone thinks like that the iconic 360 shot of all six of them just looking up as the Chitauri are coming down. Like that's what movies are made of, right? That's great stuff. So is there like watching this as a member of the crew, as a major element of what made that whole thing possible? Was there like a moment in there where you were just like, that's the shot? And it's like one that you just want to just kind of frame and put up in the office?
Yes, there's probably a couple. Honestly, though, right around that area when they're all on. So that was the Park Avenue Viaduct ramp where the 360 happened.
Yeah.
We rebuilt it in New Mexico and then we shot everything, some of the pieces in New York. And I'll never forget being the only person standing on that entire viaduct ramp when we were all cleared and I'm just like locking it down, or being one of four people inside Grand Central, Grand Central Station at 4 a.m. because that's when you have to shoot if you want Grand Central cleared. But the shot that I remember most is the transition of the Hulk after he says, "That's my secret. I'm always angry." And so that transition where he's saying, we shot in Albuquerque and Mark was really nervous about taking his shirt off in front of the entire crew. I was on second unit for this with him, and I was very often the only woman on set back. And I've done a lot of tent poles, and it is mostly men. And so in that moment when Yannick Sears, our fantastic evil genius visual effects supervisor on the production side, said, you know, Mark, we need one without your shirt. And so Mark got really shy all of a sudden and looked around and found me standing behind camera and was like, "Taylor, I need you for this." And he goes, "Aww." "Taylor," he said, "Taylor, this one's for you," and did like a cute little strip tease and, you know, handed me his shirt, and I made him comfortable because we'd been together so many times when he'd been shirtless. And I like to think that I was a safe space for him. And he was just so sweet. That shot I really love because I obviously love the line is so good. I'm always angry. Yeah. And then that transition was really difficult to do in post-production, but we had such great bones because we had Mark do the action, and then we had a couple of Hulk stand-in guys. We actually had a guy that we called Green Steve, and it was a giant, muscly guy that we painted green. And we would have him do reference and film him doing the Hulk's actions as a texture reference. And so this poor guy was such a good sport, and we painted him green, and poor makeup had to keep painting him because it was Albuquerque and he was sweating. And we had Mark and we had Green Steve, and then we had a mocap performer that did Hulk as well. And so I love marrying all those things together and seeing that great transformation shot, which there was a little feature on it in the Academy Museum in an exhibit.
And do you get access to the scripts and everything, and you look through it and you're just like, wow, I really want to be a part of this one?
Yes, that does happen. I mean, if you're lucky enough to work on movies that you want to, it's pretty rare in my experience, though, because the cyclical nature of the industry, it's like it's hard to get back in sync with people you want to work with since you're on a job for a year or a year and a half. And so it's really special, and it doesn't happen often when everything comes together and you can work with who you want to work with and on a project you want to work on, because I won't lie, I did not want to work on Fast and Furious.
Yeah.
But I did. And I got to do a movie called Bad Times at the El Royale. And that was the Cabin in the Woods, same writer-director, Drew Goddard. And so that was really fun. And we kind of got the band back together on that. And I got to work with some of my best friends. So that was incredibly special, but a very rare and lucky thing.
Now, and speaking of working with the Cabin in the Woods team, when you got that script, That script is fantastic.
Well, I wasn't a horror fan, and I really didn't become a horror fan until the pandemic, to be honest. But I would get homework on Cabin in the Woods, and everyone would say, "This line is an homage to this movie. Go home and watch it." My knowledge of horror expanded rapidly. Honestly, there's still stuff in that movie that scares me when I watch it, and I know what's coming. It was so crazy, and trying to wrap my head around the second half of the script, which we just kind of referred to as Monster Chaos. Literally on the day when we were shooting content for the monitors of the Monster Chaos, it was really just like, it was the middle of the night, and over the walkie, they just said, can anyone think of anything to bring over to shoot, like, because we were just like desperate for monster weird ideas, and we had run out. And so I grabbed a plant off of somebody's desk and held it really close to the camera, and then there was a person I did like a forced perspective, like plant monster type of thing. But it was a really fun environment where everyone was like open to just making it creepier and cooler. And someone in the elevator scene with the blood on the floor, someone fell in the blood every single day. I think the last day of it was finally Drew, the director, fell.
You think he did it on purpose just to kind of like, you know, just kind of take the edge off?
Oh, I know everyone? He did not. He didn't. He was not happy. No.
Oh, really?
No, it was gross. It was so gross. It was disgusting. Wow. But that was a really fun one. And yeah, I had no idea how this movie was going to come together. And it was a fascinating process to see, for sure.
And just like as it unfolded, it was just getting like I was just getting like more and more like hyped up with it. And the constant back and forth between with Bradley Whitford and Richard Jenkins.
Oh, the best.
Just hysterical. Like, I mean, mm-hmm. just like with Mordecai, the Harbinger, yes. and everything, just like that whole scene had me crying with laughter. It was so funny. And it's all visual effects because there was always something going on in
yes.
that part of it as well.
Mm-hmm. So, yes, there was a lot of cleanup of the zombies. I mean, the little zombie mm-hmm. girl had one arm missing, so that was a blue sock that we painted out. The zombies were so good. I mean, we didn't have to touch them makeup wise; they were perfect. But just some like normal cleanup type stuff, and so it really was the elevators and everything that went in there. Yeah. And we had a unit that was just shooting elevator content, and so it would just be a whole unit of things coming in and out of the elevator. We had like dogs, we had, you know, all sorts of people dressed up. And then we had a macro unit where we put bugs in mm-hmm. a tiny elevator and did a forced perspective thing there. And then when we got to post, it was very creepy. I didn't like any of it, but when we got to post, then we, of course, when you get to post, your ideas are bigger and better because you've lived mm-hmm. and learned and you've shot the movie and you're like, oh, I wish we could double or triple the amount of elevators when we do the big pullback shot of all the elevators full of monsters. And so we were once again working with Rhythm and Hughes and asked them to comb their library for anything that was not IP and we could put in the containers. So I think they had like a CG frog and there's a bunch of CG creatures, animals that are kind of generic that are in those elevators that we just wanted to populate with as much stuff as possible. Shoot the shot where the elevator doors open on the emergency team. We shot that in like 30, 40 layers, each element shot on its own and then compiled into the final shot. And looking at it now, that shot really suffers from some, I guess, just kind of sitting everything in there. The roto was not great. Like, it just kind of looks a little cut out now. It looks a little dated, which I'm disappointed about. I'd love mm-hmm. to have a chance to do it again. But it is an incredible shot. And I just love the, like, you know, at work, you just get to talk about an angry molesting tree and talk about what... Like, and have it a serious conversation about like, what's the molesting tree doing and where are his branches? And we have to map out every pixel of the angry molesting tree or the robot. It's a trip.
But I would have reached out to Sam Raimi just like with the angry molesting tree and just mm-hmm. like, what do you think? Is this angry enough, do you think? Because God knows he's got the experience with that.
Yeah. The tree just wanted a buddy. He just wanted someone to love.
There you go.
But yeah, that was super fun. And there's just so many different things in there and some really great, like there's a couple of great little tricks that we didn't do much visual effects to. Like there's an overhead shot of, I think they're called like scarecrow people at the end that kill, I forget what his name is, that kill the guy that's kind of like the security guy for...
Who's not like really into everything that's going on. Like
he was not into anything that was going on. Yes.
He didn't want to place bets.
And so when he dies, there's like an overhead shot and we just cut frame to frame straight to dummies, from people to dummies, and you don't even notice it because the editing is, you know, it's just lined up so nicely. So we do help lining up the shots and making them look seamless, and editorial assists are a big part of it. So yeah, that movie was quite a fun combination of practical and CG.
Yeah, and the results were just phenomenal. Like
yeah.
Truly, truly love that movie.
And then
so much
Sigourney
fun.
Weaver at the end, just to put a cherry on top.
Oh, it's perfect. I mean, you can't ask for a better one. Like the greatest female main character in all of horror. You know, like that's right there.
I was talking to the actor, Fran, that plays Marty, and I was like, can you believe that the last 2 days your job has been to roll around on the floor with Sigourney Weaver? He's like, I have no idea how I got here, and this is amazing. Like, it was so cool.
Well, that is fantastic. Now, every now and then there's a movie that is just like, okay, this came together, and there are plans for going further. But then all of a sudden, you know, like because of either the box office didn't agree or something happened that just caused the production company to just start going in a different direction. It happens from time to time. One of them, the biggest one from my perspective, was the second Amazing Spider-Man movie, because that was setting up to be like not only the third one, but then a Sinister Six movie. And it was going to be like mm-hmm. the whole universe. And yes. then all of a sudden it just stopped. And then here comes Tom Holland stepping mm-hmm. in to join the MCU. So what was it like working on that second film? Because you're also taking on a sequel as well.
That's true. That yeah. There's definitely a lot that you're inheriting when you take on a sequel. It was a challenge in that you're still getting people watching it saying this doesn't look real. And it's like, okay, but this is the fifth Spider-Man movie in the modern era. And a guy is never going to look real, because no one knows what it looks like for a dude to swing across buildings in New York. There was a lot of that on Spider-Man, trying to please a lot of people. And I wasn't really a fan of the first one of that franchise. But I think it just got all a little cartoony. And with, you know, Paul Giamatti as the Rhino.
Rhino.
Was just so campy. And I loved it, but he was kind of in the wrong movie. It was a weird balance. There was a lot of goofy stuff in that movie. But then we also had some very serious actors. Like, I mean, I really thought Dane DeHaan was going to be the next big thing. And it's hard with IP because you have so many people to please. Not only the directors and the producers, the studio, the people that own the character. You know, one of the producers was Avi Arad, who owns the character of Spider-Man. And so he would come in and look at shots and give us notes. And so it's just a lot of cooks in the kitchen about Spider-Man, which was like weird for me, just because I'm not a comic books person. And so, you know, that was a big lesson for me to learn on Avengers, was like how precious these characters are to people and really respecting that. And that was fun. You know, that was one of the last movies that I shot that really had a lot of big practical sets, huge practical sets, just like Avengers did. And those kinds of movies aren't made as often anymore, unfortunately. Yeah. But, you know, we were in the Park Avenue Armory shooting the clock tower sequence, like right there in the middle of Manhattan. And honestly, I think that the two of them, Emma Stone and Andrew Garfield, looked too old. This was my personal, I was like, they look like they're 30, 40. They don't look like they're young and trying to figure it out. And I'm a fan of both of them.
I was absolutely overjoyed to see Andrew Garfield get a bit of redemption in Spider-Man No Way Home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just that was great.
Just that to me was just like wonderful. And to have his moment to actually get to save MJ the way that he did. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a crowd-pleasing moment. You know, great to see moments like that. One of the things that they always say about different films, and especially with the blockbuster movies, is that like the budgets are just getting way out of hand and everything. Mm-hmm. Like they're going for $100 million, then $200 million, then $300 million, whatever it winds up. Considering that there are so many people now that are trying to get their own work out there, they're trying to use whatever they have at their disposal. Like there's so many different movies right now that are getting shot on iPhone, and some of them, and quite a few of them, have been theatrically released. So do you have any sort of tips or anything for anyone who is kind of like looking to add some additional sheen to their work, but at the same time, not let their budgets go out of control?
Gosh, I mean, you've got to have.
I know it's asking a lot. Yeah, it's a,
it is. Well, you know, you've got to have the. If you don't have the money, you've got to have the time. And the talent. And so it's about finding either a small visual effects company or a guy that just works out of his garage, which there are plenty of talented artists that are not attached to a vendor, and working with them. Both sides kind of have to take a chance. And it's like you have the opportunity to showcase your work under these do you want to do that? And so a lot of people say yes, just because they want to work. And another thing, I'm just hoping that studios will bring back small and medium sized budgets, because those are the ones that have kind of disappeared. Everyone's concentrating on their tent poles. And I just finished working on a delightful movie that had under 500 visual effects shots, but was very hard work and a smallish budget for Hollywood, like under 30 million. And so as visual effects, I was the largest line item in that budget. Mm-hmm. And so there was a lot of eyes on us, and a lot of people don't understand why visual effects cost so much because they just don't understand the process. And so it's hard to fight for the money that you need. I mean, even on these giant movies, I'm reading a script and I'm saying, okay, you've got $10 million of visual effects here. And they'll say, you know, can you do it for six? And then we'll figure out how to do it for six. And then at the end of the day, it might not work. And everybody decides after we shoot it that we do need that extra bump. And so retroactively in post, we get more money for an overage. And that takes the movie up to where the filmmakers want to see it. But studios are really hesitant to give you any money when they haven't quite, like before the dailies, before the movie's proven that it's going to be a movie.
Yeah. And so for those who want to get into the field that you're in terms of working in visual effects, what is one tip that you would give them to kind of give them an idea of what it is that they're stepping into?
I would recommend someone choose to work at a visual effects company because it's much more stable. It's been hard to find a job these last few years since they're not making as many movies. But as you said, there will always be a need for visual effects. So it's those companies that are fighting to stay in business and, you know, taking jobs at half of their rate and just getting their work out there. It's like weirdly the same at every level. Like everyone wants to keep working and you just kind of have to figure out how to force yourself in there. From there, you're going to learn a lot. I would also say just get any PA job on set. Anything, any department, because visual effects interacts with every single department and you need to know how to be a PA, how to support your team and how to work with other departments. And so that's one thing I would do is just get on set. Doesn't matter how or where. And from there, you'll meet people in the department that you're interested or you'll learn about a new department you didn't know and you'll find your people. And then that can really help you figure out your next steps.
And considering the everything that you've been doing, everything that you are doing, do you have time to get on social media? And if so, where can my listeners find you?
Yes, I'm on social media. I'm on Instagram. My handle is the words red wheelbarrow without the vowels, RDWHLBRRW. I also run a storytelling show here in Los Angeles where I am called the NDA show. And it's a storytelling show where we're breaking our NDAs and we're talking about the crazy. I really needed an outlet and I needed a room of people to listen to me talk about how ridiculous and awesome my job is. No recording, no streaming, one night only type of transparency and exclusivity. Yeah, but it's been really fun and it's very cathartic and fun to have people from every single department tell stories and all around this common goal of trying to make a movie or a TV show.
And do they just say like, so this actor said to me, or are they naming names?
People are as transparent as they want to be. People are naming names. People are naming names. And it's just being able to relate to someone who had a shitty boss, but they're in the movies, makes it interesting. And so it's such a relatable thing. And the things that happen on movie sets are just ridiculous and people deserve to know. So yes, I've had people naming names and also people just insinuating and it's pretty easy to figure out. So it's what everybody's comfortable with, but it's really about being transparent and, the stories are mostly positive, but not all of them. So I call it the nightmares and miracles of working in film and TV, because that's what you witness.
The nightmares and the miracles. I can't think of a better exclamation point on this whole discussion than that right there. Because yes, there are nightmares and miracles in the field that you want to get involved in. And Taylor has definitely proven that she has gone through the nightmare. She has also experienced the miracle. And this field, this wonderful field that is visual effects in film and television, it's such a crucial element of what makes these movies what we love. So I truly hope that you have not only been enjoying this conversation, but also feel just as inspired as I am about getting that work out there, getting that work finished, getting it into the right hands, because there are a lot of people out there that are ready to bring those ideas to life and are ready to have a whole lot of fun doing it. So I truly hope that all of you have been enjoying this and are running with this, because in these crazy times, we need your stories, your vision, your ideas now more than ever. So for Taylor Rockwell, this is George Soroy saying to all of you, ever upward, and I will see you next week.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of Excelsior Journeys. I hope it was both inspiring and entertaining. Special thanks to Zach Comtois for providing new music for the intro and outro. Please take a moment to leave a rate and review on Apple Podcasts. And if you enjoy the show, please share it with your friends and subscribe to your platform of choice by going to hesgotit.com/podcasts. While there, you can also fill out the application to be a guest, inquire about sponsorship opportunities, and click on the Buy Me a Coffee link if you wish to give your support to the show. All interaction is very much appreciated. If you have a question, comment, or suggestion for the show, please direct it to George@hesgotit.com.